This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is scheduled to meet North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un Sunday in Pyongyang, his fourth trip to the North this year, third as Secretary of State. President Donald Trump last week pointed to a second summit with the North Korean leader following his first June meeting in Singapore. Plans for a late August trip by Pompeo were canceled amid growing concerns over a lack of progress toward the North's denuclearization. But State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert Tuesday spoke of forward progress.
We continue to have these conversations, and I think it shows forward progress and momentum that the secretary is making his fourth trip back in less than a year. The first, of course, was as CIA director. This will be his third as Secretary of State. And that shows the president's commitment to the agreement that he and Chairman Kim came to at the Singapore summit.
North Korea's foreign minister told the UN last week international sanctions presented an impediment to his government's goodwill gestures of ending nuclear missile testing and dismantling a nuclear test site. But now it signaled no change in U.S. policy.
Sanctions remain in full effect, not just the United States sanctions, U.N. Security Council resolutions, and the other countries that fully backed those Security Council resolutions. All of that remains in effect. We are not easing the pressure in that regard at all.
Pompeo will also visit South Korea, Japan, and China during the trip. In Beijing, he's expected to discuss bilateral, regional, and global issues with his Chinese counterparts. First Lady Melania Trump embarked on a week-long four-country visit to Africa Tuesday with a stop in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. She was greeted by her Ghanaian counterpart, Rebecca Akufo-Addo, in a welcoming ceremony of drums and dancers. The American First Lady visited child health facilities and met caregivers. She's focusing her trip on her Be Best campaign aimed at improving children's welfare. She also stops in Kenya, Malawi, and Egypt. This is VOA News. On Indonesia's Sulawesi Island, time is running out as rescuers dig through debris for survivors of Friday's 7.5 magnitude earthquake and tsunami that left more than 1,200 dead and hundreds injured. Still more hundreds are missing. Tens of thousands have been displaced. The natural disaster felled apartment buildings, shopping areas, and entire neighborhoods. Roads and bridges have been damaged, making access to isolated affected communities almost impossible. Matthew Cochran is with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies.
The situations that the team described are incredibly difficult. It took them 1.5 hours to carry each of the bodies out to nearby ambulances, having to wade through incredibly deep mud. The sense from the teams who are working there, from colleagues on the ground, is one of real frustration. The access issues that my colleagues have spoken about are very difficult to overcome. There are still large areas of what might be the worst affected areas that haven't been properly reached, but the teams are pushing, they're doing what they can.
The government is attempting to airlift humanitarian supplies in, is attempting to beef up security to guard against looting. According to the Moroccan Navy and Spanish charity Walking Borders, at least 34 migrants, all from Africa, died in a shipwreck of their damaged inflatable boat in the western Mediterranean, apparently trying to reach Spain. The boat was adrift since Sunday with 60 on board. The rest appeared to have survived. Russia says it delivered advanced S-300 surface-to-air missiles to Syria. Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said the deployment, including four missile launchers, is aimed at protecting Russian military personnel. Moscow decided to pursue the deployment after an older Syrian missile battery mistakenly shot down a Russian reconnaissance plane with 15 on board, believing it was an Israeli warplane operating in the area. In Ethiopia, tens of thousands have fled ethnic violence in the west. The violence erupted Friday in the Benishangul-Gumuz region after several local officials were killed during a visit to the neighboring Oromia region. State-affiliated media said more than 40 have been killed. In Armenia, Tuesday, thousands gathered outside parliament in the capital Yerevan, led by Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, demanding early elections. The former opposition leader is opposed to a delay in carrying out elections approved by parliament in June. U.S. Central Bank Chairman Jerome Powell said he's upbeat about the U.S. economy.
The unemployment rate stands at 3.9%, near a 20-year low. Inflation is currently running near the FOMC's 2% objective. A wide range of data on jobs and prices does support a positive view.
At the same time, U.S. stocks hit another record high Tuesday with the benchmark Dow Jones closing up another 122 points to 26,773. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, October 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There's been a new development in the controversial $16 billion saga in Liberia.
The Central Bank of Liberia wants to clarify to the general public and our partners in progress that there is no $16 billion Liberian missing, as has been erroneously reported in the media.
Nathaniel Petre is governor of the Central Bank of Liberia. Front Page Africa editor Rodney Sia will join us this morning to explain the implications of the new developments. A decision by the state-run Zambian Times newspaper to publish an article in the Chinese Mandarin language is generating a big controversy. And South Sudan President Salva Kiir changes the name of the National Army.
First of all, what is very important at this stage is not really changing the name of the army, because what we have in Juba is not an army. What we have in Juba is just a collection of tribal militias who are loyal to Salva Kiir.
Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel is the deputy military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. The East African community is called upon to actively engage in restoring peace and stability in South Sudan. And September saw the highest death rates for migrants crossing the Mediterranean. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There's been a new development in the controversial $16 billion Liberian dollar scandal. It comes at a time when the Federal Reserve Bank in New York this week temporarily put a hold on all transactions with the Central Bank of Liberia, pending clarification over a court order preventing 33 Liberian bank officials allegedly connected with the $16 billion saga from leaving the country. The U.S. Reserve Bank is responsible for the Central Bank of Liberia's foreign transfers and payments. On Tuesday, the governor of the Central Bank of Liberia, Nathaniel Petre, called a news conference and declared that the $16 billion was in fact not missing as alleged.
The Central Bank of Liberia wants to clarify to the general public and our partners in progress that there is no $16 billion Liberian missing, as has been erroneously reported in the media. The CBA has no record shown that monies printed under its authority have not yet been delivered into its reserve vaults. Records from Crane Currency of Sweden, which were contracted to print the money, show that Crane delivered 15.5 billion Liberian dollars through the free port of Monrovia and Eraba International Airport between 2016 and 2018, and that all these monies were logged by the CBL and delivered into the reserve vaults of the Central Bank of Liberia.
Governor Petre, who did not answer reporters' questions at his news conference, said the Central Bank of Liberia will cooperate with the committee set up by President George Weah to look into the $16 billion controversy. He called on the Liberian Justice Ministry to withdraw the court order which put travel restrictions on Central Bank of Liberia officials allegedly implicated in the $16 billion controversy.
I confirm that all employees of the Central Bank of Liberia are committed to cooperating fully with the investigation and will continue to make themselves available to the special investigative team whenever they are called upon. In view of all of what I have said, and so as not to interrupt the smooth operation of the CBL, I am requesting the government of Liberia to vacate the rate, thus removing the travel restriction on the CBL staff.
Nathaniel Petre is the governor of the Central Bank of Liberia. He spoke Tuesday during a news conference in Monrovia. Joining us to talk about the implications of the new developments in the $16 billion Liberian scandal is Rodney Sia, publisher and editor-in-chief of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper. Good morning to you, Rodney.
Good morning, James.
So nice to have you on Daybreak Africa. Do you think the governor's statement did anything at all to move the needle in terms of the Liberian people's suspicion about this mysterious $16 billion?
Well, James, the suspicions have not gone away. In fact, at the press conference, our reporters who were there were not given the chance to ask questions The governor just read the statement and walked away. So people are very, very unhappy. They're not sure whether the government is sincere about this investigation, especially coming after the government had announced that the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation was going to be called in to help with the investigation of this money. And now they're coming and saying that no money was missing, undermining the investigation. People are not happy about that.
The governor requested that the government lift the writ of Ne-Exit Republica, which the Justice Ministry issued, preventing certain people, particularly staff from the Central Bank of Liberia, from leaving the country. Tell us, what does this mean?
Well, what it means, James, is that in the last 72 hours, the U.S. Federal Reserve in New York, responsible for the Central Bank of Liberia's foreign transfers and payments, put a temporary hold on all the transactions with the Central Bank of Liberia, pending the clarification over an instruction from the Monrovia City Court regarding some officials of the bank who were linked to this missing money. You can recall the Deputy Governor Charles Sirleaf, who's the son of former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, was among 30 people who were placed on travel ban by the court on this writ that was issued. So the New York Federal Reserve had issues with that and made their concerns known to the Central Bank of Liberia. So the issue with this money and the central bank decision was in line with trying to appease the U.S. Federal Reserve in New York so that they can remove the temporary hold on the transaction of the central bank.
Does this admission by the central bank governor that, first of all, I don't think there's a difference between $15.5 billion and $16 billion. So by saying that they know about $15.5 billion, what does it do to the investigating committee that President Weah set up? Does this mean that the investigation is over?
You can pretty much say that, because I think most people feel that the governor's statement was preceded by the president himself, who spoke on Sunday upon his arrival from New York, where he attended the UN General Assembly and said that no money was missing. And right after that, the central bank governor comes out and say the same thing the president said. So most people are saying that the governor of the central bank is doing what the president wants him to do.
Rodney, where does that leave the statement that Information Minister Eugene Nabe made initially? What does that do with that statement now?
That's the billion-dollar question, James, because Mr. Nabe, in an interview with the VOA, Daybreak Africa, explained that monies were printed in two or three different countries. In fact, it was Minister Nabe who said it was not initially $9 billion that was involved, but it was actually $16 billion. Now the question becomes, where did he get that information from? And who authorized him to make that information public? There must have been some discussion internally for Mr. Nangbe to come and tell the public and tell the international community that monies were printed in several different countries. Today we hear a different story, that the money was only printed in Sweden. So the issue becomes, who's telling the truth?
Is it the case now of the Weah government backtracking?
That could be the case, James, because a lot of people are unsure. We've heard several variations from the Minister of Justice, from the Minister of Finance, from the Minister of Information on this one issue. Different stories. So we don't know who's telling the truth. I think it seems like yesterday's press conference was a way of maybe setting the pace for this controversy to go away. But most Liberians you speak to on social media also and in the country, they're very, very unhappy with this decision. And they feel strongly that the central bank governor, Nathaniel Petri, has betrayed this country and betrayed those who have strong feelings that something is amiss.
Rodney, we are always very happy to have you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you for your analysis.
Thank you, James.
Rodney Sears, publisher and editor-in-chief of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper. He was speaking with us from London. Today's Wednesday, October 3rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Uganda members of parliament have called on the East African community to actively engage in restoring peace and stability in South Sudan and Burundi. This comes after the regional body, which comprises six countries, failed recently to address political challenges facing some member countries. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha in Tanzania.
During a fact-finding mission by the Ugandan lawmakers in the East African Community headquarters in Arusha, Tanzania, members expressed their concern on the regional body's failure to address political challenges faced by the partner states. South Sudan and Burundi are member states of the East African Community, which the regional body has so far failed to restore peace and stability after several years of instability. James Boliba Baba is a lawmaker from the Ugandan parliament.
Some of our member states are in serious trouble. South Sudan, Burundi, they have not stabilized very well. What are we as East Africans doing about solving their problems? What support are we lending? We have left this process to the IGAD process, which is outside EAC.
South Sudan is the latest country to join the East African Community after Burundi and Rwanda joined in 2007. A political dispute between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar sparked a war in December 2013 that led to more than 50,000 people losing their lives. Martin Ngoga is the Speaker of the East African Legislative Assembly.
The region not being fully involved to deal with the conflicts, why can the community seem to be indifferent on issues that affect some of our partners? This community needs an honest discussion to assess the state of the relationship.
The Speaker of the Regional Parliament said that lack of common ideology and political will are the major challenges the region is facing.
Until you have a regional parliament that is really regional, that is not a reflection of home sentiment, then you cannot make any difference. If you have members of regional parliaments who come, cannot even form an opinion until they make a phone call, you know, then you can't make progress. So I think one weakness where we need to work seriously is to make sure that the institutions we have that are supposed to serve the community really serve the community.
According to the East African Community, more than 1.2 million South Sudanese refugees are hosted by Uganda, the largest refugee number of a single country in Uganda. The only conflict that the region stepped in is of Burundi, which is yet to be successful after more than 3 years. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir Tuesday changed the name of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, SPLA, to the Sudan People's Defense Forces, the SSDPS. The revitalized peace agreement signed last month calls for the formation of a revitalized transitional government of national unity and a unified army, police, and other security forces. But Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, deputy military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, says President Salva Kiir cannot unilaterally change the name of what he calls the tribal militia in Juba.
First of all, what is very important at this stage is not really changing the name of the army, because what we have in Juba is not an army. What we have in Juba is just a collection of tribal militias who are loyal to Salva Kiir. That is why we signed the peace agreement. The peace agreement says we are supposed to be united together after a very serious training and deployed in Juba. Then we'll become a national army. But at the moment, how does he just from the blue decide to change the name of the army? It's not right. Because what is, first of all, is for him to implement the revitalized access. He declared ceasefire, yes, but even after yesterday, they are still attacking our forces. So that change of name is really nothing serious. It's just a waste of time.
But President Salva Kiir is the president of South Sudan, and can we say that this step taken can be just another step towards the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement?
He cannot implement the revitalized peace agreement alone. We are supposed to implement together, and the change of name is supposed to be a process, not now. And that is when we are now together, we are united. It's a new force, a new armed forces trained, and a national force at the moment. Because right now, we are yet divided. We are HPLIO under Riek Machar, and his forces were HPLIG under his own command. We cannot have a national army. That army, as I said before, is a tribal army. It's not national. You know, we know history. What it's trying to do is avoid the issue of the unification of forces and bring what we call integration. He just wants our forces to be integrated into this national army that he has branded right now. So he will be claiming that, okay, what he has got is now a complete national army, not the HPLIO, not the HPLIG. So we will be forced to be integrated into the South Sudan Defense Forces, which is wrong. What is important right now is for him to cease all hostility, order his forces to disengage and move out from wherever they have captured from us and implement the RCS accordingly. This is not the first time Salva Kiir decided to go past the document that was signed. First, he decided to call our chairman to come to Juba before the due date. The due date is after 8 months, but now he wants him to go to Juba. Secondly, he decided to do this, telling the name. So he's acting not within the revitalized assets, he's acting outside the revitalized assets. What he's doing that is acting on his own and trying to achieve his agenda.
You just said that the South Sudan Army is tribal. If President Salva Kiir did not change the name of the army, wouldn't you have said again that it was not inclusive?
You know, changing name is not a problem. The problem is changing the system itself. If you change the name, but the system is still the same, what has it been? Nothing has been so far. They are still the same people and under the same commander. Untrained, tribal, and so violent, and they like causing atrocities. Now, what kind of art is that? Even if you change the name, as long as the people remain the same, it's a waste of time.
Colonel Lampaul Gabriels, the deputy military spokesman for the SPLAIO, he was speaking with me from Kampala, Uganda. A decision by the state-run Zambian Times newspaper to publish in its Tuesday edition an article in the Chinese Mandarin language is generating a big controversy. Civil society groups have condemned the publication, saying that the newspaper has yet to publish an article in any of Zambia's dominant local languages. They also said that the paper is appeasing China, which has loaned Zambia billions of dollars over the past several years. Their remarks came after Information Minister Dora Silia wrote on Twitter that the Mandarin article was meant to generate more revenue for the newspaper from the growing Chinese market. Laura Miti is leader of the Alliance for Community Action, a civil society group in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
With absolute amazement, shock, I think, and I'd say great unhappiness. It was totally out of the blue at first. I mean, if it was 1st of April, would have thought it was an April Fool's joke. But yes, the Minister for Information explains it as a paper trying to increase its readership and therefore business. But Zambians have not reacted too happily to it.
But isn't it good that at this time when a lot of media companies are having problems, it will be advantageous for the Times of Zambia to try to expand its revenue base?
I suppose it's a question of this taps into larger questions in the country. So at a time in which citizens are generally suspicious about the relationship of the country with China, fed partly with the amount of debt we have and partly, I think, with rumors that are not entirely true about certain parts of the country being taken over. So I think there's a real sense that if you're not careful, we'll wake up one day and we'll be a province of China. So it is that. I think at any other time, if, for example, they had published in Spanish, the response would not be as negative.
Some Zambians are saying that although they appreciate what the government is doing, this is a national pride, and then to do so undermines Zambia's sovereignty. Do you share that assessment?
I agree that there's something about that defines us as Zambians. So in your national paper, you cannot put a whole article that cannot be read by the majority of citizens. It's an English paper. We've never seen Tonga or Bemba or any of the local languages published in that paper. So why for the Chinese? And how many are they in the country? Are they more than we think? Like someone was asking, is it the 8th official language? So it is, I think, problematic. And my sense is really that you have a government that somehow does not really understand its own people and does not read the mood of the country very well. So right now is not the right time.
Well, Laura, people are expressing concern about the timing of this report, particularly when a few days ago, Professor PLO Lumumba, who was scheduled to speak in Zambia, critical of the Chinese influence in Africa, was prevented from entering Zambia because of what the government described as a security risk.
Exactly. So first of all, Professor Lumumba is denied entry. So it seems as though our government is beholden, almost captured by the Chinese. So it is Chinese interest before national interest, because Professor Lumumba is an eminent academic. It's good for the university students to hear him. It's good for the country to hear him. Yet denying citizens to hear alternate voices and respected voices. it's not something that is usual generally in Zambia. Of course, we've, under the PF government, two other people have denied entry. But then it is this sense that there, a few days later, you then go and publish an article in Chinese. So it's all about China. Whatever China wants, China gets.
Laura Miti is the leader of Alliance for Community Action, a Zambian civil society group. She spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Lusaka. September saw the highest death rates for migrants crossing the Mediterranean, and researchers say they see no end in sight as long as Italy's current policy forbidding search and rescue ships continues. Matteo Villa, an expert on Italian policy towards migration, tells Ricky Stryer how the far-right government is having an impact on the lives of migrants.
The death rate has spiked as search and rescue operations have dwindled in the Mediterranean. Right now, there is nobody who is able to do search and rescue operations apart from the Libyan Coast Guard near the Libyan coast. So it's clearly a risk. Migrants are still departing. The rationale behind the deterrent strategy by the Italian government saying that no search and rescue operations should be done next to the Libyan coast was that migrants would have been deterred from departing. But this is not happening enough to discourage people from departing, enough for absolute death to go down. So it's not just the death rate that has spiked, but also the number of people who risk losing their lives. So we've moved from about 3 dead per day in the 11 months before the current government to 8, so it's more than double that.
The mayor of Reace has been arrested, and he and the town are kind of known for a place in Italy that really integrates migrants and refugees. Do you think this is a political move?
I don't think it's necessarily a political move. For sure, what was happening around Reace in the last few months was very politically motivated. So, I mean, this inquiry has gone on, and it's most likely that this arrest will have no consequences, long-term consequences for him, because even the prosecutor is saying that the accusers against him are not, the charges raised against him are not very, very considerable. So I think that the whole climate that has built up against this community, this small town that has made integration the first thing and it's become a model for Italy, has been worsening for months. This new government was cutting all the help, the aid, the financial aid that was coming from the central government to Reace. They suspended the funds, and then again they opened it up once there was a court decision.
As it gets colder, I imagine the crossing gets actually more dangerous. So people can die of hypothermia, etc. So if there are no rescue ships, are you concerned that the death rate will go up?
Actually, I mean, the death rate is so high. It's never been this high before, and they expect it to get lower. I want to say that more than 20%. I don't expect this to, you know, stay this high for months. The problem is not just death rate. It's really the number of people that really that tend to die at sea. And for now, it's increased very much. Let's see whether during this autumn and winter, departures go down. But I don't expect them to be too low. There is no search and rescue operation in the area. So that really made the risk that has always gone varied between 2% and 8%, gone up to 20%.
That was Matteo Villa, an expert on Italian policy towards migration. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from near Milan. That is it for this Wednesday, October 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.